Hi, everybody. Dr. Ken Kosick from the medical school is talking to us today about genetics and as it connects to migraine education, and it's a really wonderful opportunity for us to have him here. He's doing really important... Oh, you can't. Is this on? Yeah. No. Okay. He's doing really important, groundbreaking work on genetics and the nervous system, among other things, and I even had the experience of, you know, I thought it was great stuff, but then my brother-in-law is a biochemist, and he started telling me, well, there's this guy doing this great stuff up there that I want to connect with, and so they're now collaborating. anyway, so we have an opportunity to hear Ken tell us about some of this, some of these ideas in genetics and the nervous system, and as they connect the mind, brain, and education. And Ken has the talent of being able to communicate with broad audiences about this work, which is especially important in an area where often the titles of the articles are totally incomprehensible to anyone who isn't a specialist in the field. So, Ken?
Okay, well, thank you very much. It is a pleasure to talk to this group. I think my understanding is that we're to have a bit of a conversation, not just a lecture. So I'll start the ball rolling, but please jump in anytime, ask questions, make comments, criticisms, anything is it's all open. And the way I want to start is that I've had the opportunity to speak right in this room before, and the title of the talk was, I think, From Molecules to Mind. And not sure if that's the title today, then I really want to tell you that because in looking over the syllabus of your course, we are not going to get to mind. There's really many other people that have already come and will come who are better at discussing mind than I am. We're going to really stay in the trenches with the molecules side, and then other people can carry the ball from there. So I want to start out with this picture behind me, and because this represents a little piece of a very exciting development for all scientists that's happened in the last couple years, that is the sequencing of the human genome, the instruction book for how we make life and, of course, the human brain. And this this sequence is made up, as you I think you know, of it's very simple, really. It's just a linear stretch of 3 billion bases. By bases, I simply mean any of 4 different what are called nucleotides or bases. They're just very small molecules, and you really don't even have to worry about exactly what they are. There's only 4 of them in the genetic code, and they're represented by A, T, G, or C. And by simply arranging the order of these A, T, G, C's, we have, from that kind of simple beginning, the complexity of all of life. And you can see here what is just an extremely small portion of those 3 billion nucleotides. Now, you may see that a couple of them, I think there's 2 of them on here, are in red. And the reason for that is that that's about the differences in the sequence between 2 different human beings. That most of it's the same, but the difference between you and your neighbor in a sequence about of this many nucleotides would be about 2. So that comes to about 0.1% of this entire 3 billion nucleotides, or 3 million differences between any 2 individuals. Just 3 million differences. And of course, we take advantage of those 3 million differences when people do forensic work to use DNA to track down who was indeed the criminal at a crime scene. And because those 3 million differences are enough to uniquely identify an individual. But yet, as in terms of the total sequence, it's really relatively small. And in fact, there's about 0.1% differences not only between any two human beings, but about the same number of differences between a human being and a great ape. So not that much.
Ken, it highlights what some biologists have said in conversations with me, which is that when they look at a lot of biology, they can't understand how there can be so much variation in, you know, how to deal with the extensive variation within a species. It seems like there shouldn't be very much with so few.
Yes. So indeed, it seems like there shouldn't be, because we're all more or less the same. But that's a great question, because or comment, because that's exactly what I want to sort of get to today, is to how we go through levels, and that's going to be a theme today, is to how we go through levels of biological organization, beginning with this just long, boring, linear sequence, to get into complexities like cells and whole organs and brains and whole psychological systems and populations. So so we start there, and and when we begin to look at this a little bit more deeply, it turns out that we have all these 3 billion nucleotides, and they encode what we call genes. You're all familiar with genes. The genes are making proteins. And we'll come back to that in a moment. But in this 3 billion nucleotides are buried a number of genes. A gene that might encode your eye color, genes that will encode enzymes that make cholesterol, and they set your cholesterol levels. The genes are encoding everything, all the proteins in the body. And so it was before the human genome was sequenced, there was a lot of speculation about how many genes there were lying within these 3 billion nucleotides. That is, a set of them. Maybe there's 100,000 here that make up one gene, and another 100,000 here that make another gene. How many of them are in there? And it was really very interesting, because there was so much speculation going on about the number of genes, that the people doing the sequencing in the Human Genome Project, people like Francis Collins, started a pool to bet how many genes there were. And almost all of the bets centered around 100,000. It was sort of just thought that you needed about 100,000 genes to make a person. Now, why? There wasn't really a lot of good reason for that, but that was where almost all the numbers. There were some people that said about 200,000. There were some that dipped down to around 60,000. A few even a little lower, a few even higher. And then, as all this sequence came out, and it was possible to use a number of techniques, which I can tell you about in more detail, to actually figure out how many genes there were buried in this sequence, it turned out that there were only about 30,000 genes. And there was, for some reason, there was a great disappointment in the biology community. Like, that's just not enough genes for a person. Why? And just shows what preconceptions are all about. And here was this great letdown that humans could be made up of only 30,000 genes. Well, if that wasn't bad enough, then the next letdown occurred. And that was the Genome Project is a powerful engine. It's not just sequencing the human genome, but there's a project going on sequencing genomes from great apes and from worms and from seahorses and fruit flies. So and those sequences are coming along now. And it was only about maybe a year ago when a very important agricultural product was sequenced, rice. And it turned out that rice have about 50,000 genes. Rice have more genes than we do. So clearly, the lesson is that the number of genes is not what it's all about.
My question is about who's, when you say the genome has been sequenced, if there's a tenth of a percent of difference in every person and there's 6 billion people, like, are those differences confined to certain locations? Otherwise, it seems like the question of whose genome have you sequenced, the chance that I share any one of those might be very low if those differences are
so
randomly
distributed.
That's
really an interesting story. So the human genome sequencing was a very interesting story, the way the human genome got sequenced. It was set up as one of the mission to the moon. It was that we're going to sequence the human genome. And it was set up as big science. Big science means lots of teams with sequencing machines in different sites, and it was all sponsored by the NIH, and they put together a huge expensive project to sequence the human genome. And running in parallel, there was this guy, I don't know, who's heard the name Craig Venter? Anybody? Running in parallel was this guy that people call a maverick, who was saying, you guys can sequence the human genome, but I'm going to do it, and I'm going to beat you at it, and I'm going to do it just in my own company, which was called Celera. And then, as if to prove his point, he just quickly, in about a year or two, turned out the entire genome of a fruit fly, and he was successful. He got it. He said, I have a better method than you guys. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to just shotgun sequence as much as I can. I'm going to just chop up the whole genome and sequence along. There's ways in which I can explain how you do this. There's enzymes that generate these stretches of DNA, and then you just run them through a machine and sequence them. And he's just going to take this enormous bit of DNA and just sequence it at random, and then he's going to use a powerful computer to reassemble it. And everybody told him it's not going to work. It's just too complicated to do it that way, and there's too many repetitive elements. There's places where it just goes T, 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 and it's very boring. And how are you going to know that the 20 T's here is not the same as 20 T's in someplace else? So he was criticized heavily. But it turns out that indeed, it's still debated exactly who won the race, but it may just be that he came in first by just a hair's breadth. But he was it'll be debated for a long time, because what he did, as the NIH was sequencing, they moved all of their information into the public domain, whereas he didn't. So while he was doing his work, he was also able to take advantage of what was being supported publicly. And although he probably did win the race by a little bit, it was really very much a combined effort. He demonstrated that his method can work. He deserves a lot of credit. He may get a Nobel Prize, but it really needed everything to make it happen. To get to your question, though, whose DNA was it? And of course, it was, everybody said, that it had to, that the sequencing that he was doing was his DNA. He's a very egotistical guy, and everybody just speculated that it was his DNA that he did. It was later revealed that, no surprise, it was his DNA that he sequenced. But whose DNA the NIH sequenced is really, those are anonymous, and it's probably several people that contributed depending on where it was done. To answer your question. Now, of course, there's another really interesting project, because now people want to sequence everything in sight. And one of the interesting genomes that people want to sequence, in which there's a lot of progress, is the dog genome. Dog genome is really interesting because, how many people have dogs here? So you must know that your dog has a personality, and personalities are different among different types of dogs, and German shepherds and poodles, and these personalities go along with the morphology of the dog. So are there genes that control both personality and of the dog, and those same genes might also be controlling the rest of its morphology, whether it's a German shepherd or a poodle? So the dog genome is There's a big push to do it, and again, no surprise, Craig Venter is sequencing his dog's genome. Okay, so let's now get into the into what these genes are doing. Here are these 30,000 genes, and they're doing something really marvelous. How can they do it? And so let's think of other complex systems where you might have lots of parts that you have to put together. Genes are like parts. It's the parts list for a human being. And if we think of another, what we call the gene, all of this information we call the genome. So if we think of another type of structure that has lots and lots of parts, maybe let's think of a 747, and let's call all of its parts the aeronome. And it turns out that the aeronome has also about, for at least a 747, there are about 30,000 parts. It's about the same. And yet, the point is that they can only be assembled in one way. Whereas genes have a myriad of ways in which they can be assembled. So the example I like to give here, it's a little bit simplistic, is right here, where let's call this the legome. And in the legome, of course, you can take the same part and make it into helicopters and teeter-totters and all kinds of things that are all based on basic structural elements or genes. That's what you get with genes, is this ability to mix and match. Now, so we start at that level, and we have a lot, 30,000 genes that can be played with in a lot of different ways. And I want to now just lay a little bit of background for how we're going to get to how we go from the simplicity of genes to the complexity of cells and organisms. So we're going to just have two slides here on a little bit of background and remind you about some stuff that you probably already know about a cell. And this here is a picture of a cell. You can see that here's the blue thing there is the nucleus, where the DNA is housed, and every cell in your body, with rare exceptions like red blood cells, but almost every cell in your body has a nucleus and has the instructions for making a clone of you. Every single one of your cells. That's how cloning works. That's how Dolly was cloned, taking what's called a somatic cell, not a germline cell. Taking a somatic cell, in the case of Dolly, was a cell from a mammary tissue, was taken, and the nucleus was extracted, and the information was all there to make an identical animal. So there's a nucleus, and those 3 billion nucleotides are all in there. And then what happens is something very important happens. It gets copied. The DNA gets copied. And here we're going to use these two words, which I heard before the talk. Somebody over here was talking about wanting to know the difference between transcription and translation. That's an important concept. So when the DNA gets copied to make RNA, then that's called transcription. That's an important word to know. And the reason that's so important is because if you have to know nothing else about biology, you should retain what is the central dogma of biology, that you go from DNA to RNA to protein. That is really the essence of the story. And it's, as I say, it's called the central dogma. So the DNA is copied to RNA. RNA is also made up of just a whole bunch of these same nucleotides. It's very similar. There's some small chemical differences between DNA and RNA, but it's very, very similar. But RNA now leaves the nucleus. It goes out of the nucleus into the cytoplasm. And that's depicted there as these ribbons coming out. I'll show you a better picture. There it is. There's one of the RNA ribbons, that red ribbon coming out. It's now been, the DNA has been copied, and there's an RNA that's leaving the nucleus, and now it's out in the cytoplasm. And these little structures here called ribosomes attach to the RNA, and they ride along the RNA, and they read out each one of the codons, each set of three nucleotides is read out, and it would say, okay, here's an A and a T and a G. An A and a T and a G equals a certain amino acid. An ATG happens to equal a methionine. And it calls one of these yellow dots. The yellow dots are amino acids. It calls it in and says, okay, we have an ATG here. We have to find a methionine. We're going to put a methionine right here. And then the next one, and line up all these amino acids until you get a complete protein. So that's the, that, and that is translation. Okay, so making protein from RNA is translation. Making RNA from DNA is transcription.
And it's important. Transcription precedes translation generally in the process.
Pardon me?
Transcription precedes translation.
That's right. Transcription would precede translation. So, okay. Now, right away, of course, and we'll talk more about this, this allows different levels of complexity to enter into the whole system, because every time you make a copy, you can make mistakes, you enter up, there's the RNA has different properties than the DNA, the protein has different properties than either of the other two. You can start to add in all kinds of complexity, which we'll talk about. Now, let's talk now about transcription in a little bit more detail. I told you that there's these 3 billion nucleotides, right? And within them are genes. Let me describe that a little bit better. It turns out that of the 3 billion nucleotides, only about maybe 97% or 98%. Only about 2%, 2 or 3% of all of those nucleotides are encoding genes. Only 2%, 2 or 3%. What's all the rest of it? Here's 97% of those 3 billion nucleotides that are not encoding any genes. People have referred to it as junk DNA. It's clearly not junk DNA, but it just means they don't know what it is.
It's the dark energy of genetics, right?
Yeah. And it is kind of dark energy because it is important stuff. It's, in a way, it's our phylogenetic, our evolutionary history lies within the DNA. Because not only does the DNA have the instructions to encode all of us, but it contains the vestiges of our evolutionary past. And I can say more about that in a few moments. So, how do we go from these 3 billion nucleotides to find and stitch together the genes that are only 2% of it? And now I want to introduce another two words that are very important that, you know, for, I think, scientific literacy, it's really important for everybody, not just scientists, to know these two words. These two words are introns and exons. How many people already know what they mean? I would think many people. Okay. So here's what we're talking about. The thin black line on the top is just a long stretch of nucleotides, the 3 billion nucleotides. And the brown boxes are just pieces of it, but the reason they're boxed is because those nucleotides are the ones that are going to be selected now for ending up to, are the genes that will ultimately be translated into protein. Okay? So the entire 3 billion nucleotides are transcribed, but only a small subset are translated. Another way to say that is that the space in between, just the thin black line, are the introns, but the part that's translated are the exons. So introns and exons are transcribed, but only exons are translated. So a gene is encoding a protein. A gene, whenever you say the word gene, it means some nucleic acid. That's what a gene is. You can't say that hemoglobin is a gene, it's a protein. You have to say the gene which encodes hemoglobin. And here are the exons. And what happens, there's a process called splicing which takes the exons and stitches them together into a full gene or a full protein. Now, some proteins, rarely a protein might be derived from just one exon. The exon, the whole protein is made in just one exon, that's it. But usually, to make a full protein, you need to stitch together several pieces. Our proteins are all broken up into little pieces. And there might be 10, 15, 20 of these different exons that have to be then assembled into this gene that gets translated. So the point here is that one of the things that is out in all of this, these nucleotides, these 3 billion nucleotides, some of what's out there are the instructions for how to stitch together the exons in the right way. You could put together, let's say that there's a protein that's made up of 3 exons, and they're different sizes. This one may have 100 nucleotides, this one may have 200, and that one may have 20. Some exons are very small. There was a discovery of a gene that has the most exons that we know about. It has something like, I don't remember the exact number, but it was in the range of about 30,000 exons. 30,000 exons were being stitched together to make this gene. Little pieces. Some of them are just 10 nucleotides, all being put together, spliced together. And why would you want to do that? Why would we need this additional complexity? Anybody have a thought on why you would want to stitch them together? Why not just put them together? Why not just encode them like this instead of having to assemble them? Why put the pieces of what will be proteins in separate places?
I'm guessing that you might use a given exon in multiple proteins. So somewhere you have encoded, you use exon A, B, and C for this protein, and exon B, C, and D for this one.
Exactly. Right on target. That is, that splicing gives you the ability to actually do to have differences. And what was I'll get to you in one moment, but there's a paper that's just about to come out I think next week in Nature Genetics from a guy named Andrew Chess at the Whitehead, who's going to be moving to the medical school, who did some work with this gene that has these 30,000 different exons. And what he discovered was that he looked at the expression of the variation of these 30,000 different exons in individual brain cells. And it turned out that you could distinguish one brain cell from its neighbor by the way these 30,000 were arranged. It actually allowed us to make distinctions between individual neurons. And that is quite an interesting discovery. You had a question. Good question. The splicing happens in the nucleus. So the DNA gets transcribed, the entire 3 billion nucleotides get copied to RNA, and now you have 3 billion nucleotides of RNA. They're still in the nucleus, and now the splicing machinery finds within the RNA these pieces. It's a really interesting process. It's something we can talk about if we had another 2 hours about just splicing. And about how the machinery to find those exons. And they're found, they're stitched together, and then it's this piece, the assembled piece, with all the introns left behind that leaves the nucleus and goes out into the cytoplasm for translation. It's a great question. Okay. So now let's talk about something else that all of that, those 3 billion nucleotides, the parts that are outside the genes, is used for. And I'm going to illustrate that with this mysterious picture here. What this is called a DNA chip. Has anyone heard of these things? Anyone? Just good. Okay. Some people have, but they're just embarrassed to raise their hand.
I get advertisements on them and for them in email all the time.
Yeah, right.
I don't know why, since I didn't do the research.
Yeah, well, I'll explain why right now. Because what these chips are is that this is a little piece of glass about the size of your thumbnail, and the fact that we now know all 30,000 genes, we can now synthesize the genes. We can actually make each gene in a test tube. That means we just take the nucleic acids in one gene and put them all together in a machine and make a lot of that series of, say, 1,000, 5,000 nucleotides that consist of that brown bar you saw on the previous slide. And I said there were 30,000 genes. Well, you could take each one of these genes and spot it at one point on this little glass slide, so that you have a glass slide now that has all the genes on it. Now what can you do with that? Well, you can now take, say we want to look at which genes are being made in the brain, or which genes are being made in the kidney. You can take some brain tissue from an animal and extract out the RNA and put it on the chip to see which genes are being turned on. Let me deconstruct that a little bit, because this is some very important concepts here. It has to do with the fact of another word I want to introduce, which is gene expression. Okay, you hear among biologists a lot expression. It's not the way an artist would use expression. They're not expressing themselves in some emotional way. They're just, all expression means is that a gene is turned on. So that every single one of your cells in your body has the DNA for every single gene. But only a subset are turned on. So if there are 30,000 genes, you may use only 17,000 of them to make a kidney. And you may use a different but overlapping set of, say, 18,000 or 19,000 to make a brain. And you might use another 13 or 15,000 to make a white cell in your blood. So while every cell has every gene, only a subset are, and here comes the word I mentioned before, only a subset are translated or are expressed. Okay? And in fact, only a subset are actually made into, while all the RNA is copied, only a subset are made into that final spliced RNA that leaves the nucleus. So that's called, that process of going from DNA to RNA, as you remember, is transcription. So only there's only transcripts for that you can find for a subset of the genes in any given cell. So the idea is that the reason they want you to buy these chips is the idea is that you can take your gene chip into the doctor's office in the future, and he'll take a little blood sample from you, and he'll extract the RNA from the blood, and then he'll put that RNA onto the chip, which has all the genes that we all have, but he'll see which one of your genes, which of those genes is turned on and turned off, and which ones are expressed at a high level and which ones at a low level, right there in his office in 5 minutes. So what, and this is showing you a chip, this is showing you genes that are turned on at different levels. So you can get genes that are completely shut off, that would be the black, and you can get genes that are turned on a lot, would be the red and the yellow, and medium levels, the blue. And now we have, and now we have another, so this really leads us to a level of complexity that's staggering. I mean, just think about how, even if you have 30,000 genes, and they can only exist in two states, on or off, just think of the numbers you have. I mean, it gets to be enormous. Now, not every one of those states exists, of course. You don't have, no one has a state where every gene is off. But, and we don't have a state where every gene is on either. But the variation is extraordinary. Now, add on top of that, that not only are genes on or off, but they're on and off to slightly different levels. And so now you can imagine that the complexity gets increasingly just enormous. Yes. Right. So that's so that gets us back to what else is lying out in those 3 billion nucleotides, because when you they're sitting in front of a gene, what we call upstream of a gene, of every gene, is a region that's called the promoter. And the promoter is determining whether the gene is turned on or turned off. And if and how, and when it's turned on, how strongly it's turned on. So that's another function of all of these, of all of these non-coding regions out there. And what was originally called junk DNA is not so much junk, but a very important control element for setting the level. Now, but that's not exactly what you asked. You asked more about what's really controlling it, not in, perhaps in a mechanistic way, not about the promoter, but what really is turning it on and off. And what promoters are sensitive to depends on the gene. So if you start to climb a mountain and you live up in a high altitude for a while, the relatively low oxygen is going to be sensed by your body, and some promoters of some genes can read oxygen levels. And those promoters will turn on genes like hemoglobin. Now, and we're going to get to this in a moment, what we're interested in here and where we would like to get to are things like learning and memory. It turns out that when we store something in long-term memory, genes are turned on. There's other genes. Obviously, these are genes that are not necessarily responsive to oxygen levels. They must be responsive to something else, like a good lecture. These are genes that seem to that are essential for moving information into long-term memory stores. And we know what some of those genes are, and I'm going to get to that in a few more moments about what those genes are, but different things can turn on genes depending on the setting that you're in. If you have an infection, you turn on genes to fight the infection that are anti-inflammatory genes. Okay, so these DNA chips are really going to transform biology. They're being rapidly commercialized, and you can even envision experiments right now. You can envision an experiment. We've done experiments like this, and I can tell you the data, where you can actually put a rat into a maze and get it to learn something, and then take out the brain, extract the RNA, and see what kind of gene changes have taken place. Really get at a molecular level as to what genes are responsible for the learning that the rat just had. Those experiments are just beginning. They're very hard to do, and I can tell you why, but that's the level of resolution we're getting to. So, now, I just wanted to, before we leave this sort of general introduction about genetics and start to move more and more into the brain side, neurobiology of all of this, I want to say, just make one more comment about genes, because it's really very apropos now that you now know about how much regulation goes on. There's this idea that genes predetermine our fate. And here's a little cartoon over here. If you want to know about your future, you can go to the reader advisor, or you can go to the geneticist. And the idea is that now the geneticist can tell you your future. Well, can the geneticist tell you your future? Is how much is encoded in the genes and how much is not? And that is, of course, still debated a lot. If you know, certain things clearly are encoded in your genes, your certain risk factors for disease are encoded in the genes, but as I've already mentioned, the genome is not static. While the sequence, what those 3 billion nucleotides are, is what you've inherited and what you've got for life. But that is just the simplest level. All the next levels of regulation, of whether they're turned on by exposure to an enriched environment, whether they're turned on by exposure to low oxygen and altitude, all is determined by the environment, not by your inherited sequences. So let's get at that a little bit. And now we can start first, let me just emphasize this point. I'm going to come back to this in a moment. Let me just show you this one first. This is an experiment which you may already know about. This was some work done by Rusty Gage. But the first person to do this kind of work was Bill Greeno. You know this work. It was putting rats or mice into complex environments and showing that there's sprouting going on of dendrites and increased synapses. You're familiar with this. The particular, what this figure is depicting actually is a finding by Rusty Gage, in which he showed that not only an enriched environment, but in this case even exercise on that wheel, increased brain complexity. And if anybody wants to stretch when we talk about that exercise piece now, this is your time to do it. The idea here is that these changes which you can measure in the brain, and that's what I'll show you what they look like right here. I'll get to this in a moment. What these changes actually look like is not just determined by the genes. This is something that has been determined in the case of the rats by their environment. So what do these changes look like? Well, here is an extremely simple system in which it's possible to demonstrate learning. This is a system, these are some neurons from a snail, a plesia, an organism that was used a lot by Eric Kandel, who recently won the Nobel Prize. And it's possible to actually show with very, very simple learning patterns that not only do genes change in their expression, but the neurons themselves are changing their shapes. So if you look at a sensory neuron here that's now synapsing on these motor neurons, there may be two synapses, and now you begin to do an experiment with this snail. And you touch one of the sensory parts of the snail, say its tail or its head, and you touch it repeatedly. And the first time you touch it, it withdraws. And then the second time it withdraws again, but a little more slowly. And the third time even more slowly. And the fourth time it doesn't even care. It doesn't withdraw at all. That's called habituation. You've already had that lecture. But the neuron itself changes. The number of synapses reduce. Likewise, if you sensitize the animal, if you give it a shock, and then the next time you just touch it lightly, it withdraws as if there was a shock. It's sensitized. And that tends to increase the amount of synapses that occur. So this is simply two cells in which you can see memory going on. Two neurons in which the snail remembers that it had been touched previously by in a harmless way or in a way that was painful. And it has, because of that experience, that learning, it actually changed its synaptic organization. So, again, we make the point here that it's, the basic point here is that genes are not predetermining what we are and who we are. Now, let's continue now on this theme as we're moving more and more toward neurons about levels of complexity. How do you want to work this? We're now at 1 hour. Does anybody do people go for 2 hours, or do they take a little break, or
no? We just
keep going. Okay.
You can pause in that conversation if you want.
Yeah.
Not pause
okay.
And leave the room.
Okay. So. Again, please interrupt me at any point if you want to jump in. So we want to try to continue on this theme about how we generate increasing levels of complexity and biological levels of organization. So you already heard about the genome, and then you also heard about the transcriptome. That was what's on that chip. Those are the genes that are actually being expressed. It's called the transcriptome because the RNA was not only copied, but the exons were selected. So that's the next level of complexity. And you can see by going from the genome, which is 30,000 genes, to an unimaginable number of different levels of transcripts. So already in this very simple set, we've introduced a level of complexity that's staggering. But it doesn't stop there. All those transcripts are making proteins. And those proteins now, those can also change, because now you have a protein that's made up of a lot of amino acids. And those amino acids can fold in different ways. Some of them can have phosphates put on them. They can have sugar groups put on them. They can also, the level of complexity of what's called the proteome is equally staggering. And then all these proteins are working together in pathways, so that we have pathways that generate energy and pathways that generate synapses and learning and all of these things in this metabolome. How our bodies are metabolizing all the proteins, shuttling them for degradation, synthesizing them, a whole metabolome, how they're all interacting with each other. And ultimately, maybe, this can lead to what we might call the cognome. And so that we go from all these levels, and there's all this space in here where at some point, maybe we might be able to put together a compendium of what the human brain can do or does do. Now, so these are just lists. They're long lists of things, like a long list of genes. But they relate to different levels of organization now, because they have to make first a cell, which is almost a self-sufficient entity. It has to function with all the genes, and it has to work in some way. And then that cell has to be now part of a team, which forms an organ, And if that organ is the brain, it has to have, some of the cells have to be neurons and some have to be glia. They have to be different types of neurons, and the Purkinje cells in the cerebellum and pyramidal cells in the hippocampus. You need to put together this whole orchestra of different cell types to make an organ. And then, of course, and now I'm saying some obvious things, but as we get to these different levels of biology, you introduce levels of complexity that we really have no understanding of. How the organs now function together in the organism, and populations and ecosystems. These are all levels in which you go, when you work your way all the way back to a single gene, and you read something like Richard Dawkins on the selfish gene, it's very hard to understand how, for me at least, how a single gene is operating with all these selection pressures when superimposed upon it, there's all this entire additional system. I don't think it's as complex. I think it's more complex than saying that a gene alone is, or a set of genes are what's driving who we are. There's this very complex interwoven system in which feedbacks occur that lead to a complete organism or population. Okay, the reason I said that is because I just want to give you an idea that there's much beyond the molecules that we're talking about today.
One of the things we focus on is development, and of course development is a big part of that process.
Absolutely.
Right? So it's maybe a way of unpacking some of the stuff you're talking about how the systems work together.
Yeah, so indeed that's really interesting because there's a lot of aspects to that. The way a biologist would think about that, to be a little different from an educator perhaps, is that what is important in development is that you have to keep the system working while the organism is being developed. It's sort of like we had to keep traffic going in Boston while the big dig was being built. And doing that means that you have to have an organism that's still very primitive, that maybe doesn't even have a complete heart yet and minimal kidneys, but it has to still survive. It has to figure out ways to survive as a still relatively incomplete organism. And of course, I'm sure that can serve as a metaphor for how we go further in development too, where a young child needs to be able to function without having all the skills that we have as adults. Okay. The next thing that I want to talk about is how we continue to build this ladder of complexity. I want to just stay on this theme even further, but talk about it now from a different perspective. To talk about it now from an evolutionary perspective, because evolutionary questions are becoming more and more dominant in the biological community. We're just increasingly appreciating that I told you how it's 0.1% differences between great apes and humans. Well, even when you go all the way back to yeast, the differences are not all that great. As we go through and look at these different genes, we find out that many genes are conserved from humans to mice to yeast, and that in a way, by doing these phylogenies, by sequencing many other organisms, what we have is a kind of a Rosetta Stone. It's a way in which we can use a simple system, just a single cell organism like a yeast, which has many of the same genes we do, and find out what those genes are doing. Because as I said, these 30,000 genes are just a parts list. Now we have to annotate the genome. We have to find out what every single gene does. And that work is really still in its early stages. We only have the shadowiest idea of what all the genes are doing. So let's think about how that might work. And it turns out that genes work together. They work as kinds of toolboxes. There are genetic toolboxes that are used to make things. So, if you want to make a limb at almost any time in evolution, you use a genetic toolbox that involves a gene called distalis. You don't have to remember the name, it's not that important, but I'll mention it to you because distal means very far out, proximal means nearby, and when there's a defect in distalis, you lose the part that's far out of the gene. It's just the proximal part. So a person that may, for some genetic reason, not have arms that might look like a baby that took thalidomide, the mother took thalidomide, might have a defect in that gene. Well, it turns out that the genetic toolbox, distalis, and its relatives have been used for millions of years to make limbs, whether it's the wings on a butterfly or all these feet on the polychaete worm or on a sea anemone or a cat or a human. It's the same genetic toolbox that is being used over and over and over again. Now, what is distalis then? What is this magic gene that goes around from species to species and confers limbs? Well, it's a gene that, and I'll give you another term that this is a term you probably should remember. It's a gene that's in a category of genes called a transcription factor. And a transcription factor, it's a very simple definition. It's a gene that encodes a protein, as all genes do, and the protein goes and turns on or turns off other genes. That's all it does. What it does is it binds to that promoter region of other genes, not all of them, some of them. The ones it binds to are all the different proteins you need to make a limb. So distalis is setting up. It's the master architect for setting up all the downstream genes that are needed to make the fingers and the hands and everything that you need to make the whole limb. Distalis goes and finds all the genes that are needed, binds to those different promoters, and turns on all those genes to get a wing or a leg or whatever else you might need. If you're a whale, might be a fin. It's very plastic. So genetic toolboxes are really a very important principle in biology. There, by the way, there's another genetic toolbox involved for making eyes. The master gene in this case is called PAX, P-A-X. Again, it's not that you don't have to remember. But it makes eyes all through phylogeny. Now, the question is that...
If it's making a wing of a butterfly or a foot of a cat, I assume that means it's promoting promoting the different cluster of genes.
Yes. So it may be promoting a slightly different cluster of genes.
Yes,
it
right.
may be promoting a similar cluster but at different levels.
Right.
It may be promoting genes that themselves have changed slightly over evolutionary time,
right.
So that the collagen for making a leg of a cat might not necessarily even be in the same program for the wing on a fly. So
right.
some genes might get left out,
right.
some added on, but the master planner is there for all of them.
Okay, thanks.
So, relevant to this talk and to this audience, the question that we would want to perhaps pose is there a genetic toolbox for learning? And I would argue that there is. I'm going to tell you about it. It's still a little shadowy, but I'm pretty sure it's there. And here's how we get there. Because again, we take advantage of evolution, of the great conservation of genes, because learning in a fruit fly, which you see here in front of you, is not too different than it is in us, at least in some regards. Now, and it's possible to use genetic techniques to actually create even a photographic memory in a fruit fly. Now, some people look puzzled by this because they're probably just wondering how it is that you would do this in a fruit fly. And there is a way. And the way is that here's how you do the experiment. You put the fruit flies into what's called a T-tube. They're at the bottom of this tube, and they fly up here, and they can go to the right or the left. And on the right is one smell, and on the left is another smell. But if they go to the smell on the right, they also get a shock. So, and they can learn that. They can learn to distinguish to go to the right or the left. And they, and it's remarkable how similar it is. They learn all of this in about 4 or 5 trials to go through the tube. They start to make the right decision to go to the left much more frequently. They learn it better, by the way, if you give them a rest period between the trials. They clearly learn it better, that these ideas that we have in humans about consolidation are there throughout phylogeny. And if they learn it really well, when they really learn it after getting 10 trials with some rest periods, they can retain that knowledge for about 2 weeks, which is a long time for a fruit fly. And they and it's very reproducible. Now, the reason people like to work on fruit flies is because you can mutate them very easily. You can just expose them to some radiation and create mutations in their genome, and then find problems and find out, and then you find out where the mutation is. So, if you can get some flies that just can't learn. You give them this test and they never seem to get it right. So it's then possible to use a number of genetic techniques, which we can talk about if you're interested in, but if there's to find out in those flies that can't learn, you can breed them in ways and do different things and find out where the gene is, what gene has the problem. It's really not too hard to do. And the gene with the problem is another transcription factor. It's a gene called CREB, C-R-E-B, and it turns on a whole bunch of other genes, and if it's absent, the fly cannot learn. But more interestingly, is that you can actually put into the fly, introduce a form of the CREB gene that's always turned on. So that when the fly is faced at the top of that T-tube trying to figure out if it should go right or left, and it knows that it just got shocked if it went to one side, maybe that's the stimulus for the fly to turn on this CREB gene. And it realizes it's in a tense situation. It could get really have an unhappy experience if it turns to the right, and it better learn which way to turn. And that is a learning enriched environment for the fly, and that environment is enough pressure to activate the CREB gene, and the CREB gene turns on and it sets up the ability to remember that left is better for this experience. Now, what it's possible, just, and this is through a very sort of a biochemical trick, because I told you that there were different, all these exons. You can take just a piece of CREB, one exon, that is just being turned on all the time in the fly. It's just there. It's just the fly's making CREB all the time. It's not waiting for a situation when it has to decide left, right, right, left. It's just on, even when it's not learning. Now, when you give a fly this what's called constitutively active CREB that's on all the time, and you put it back in this test, all you have to do is do one trial and the fly learns. This is why they use the word photographic memory. In one trial, it now learns for 2 weeks. It gets a shock to the right on one side, on one trial, and it never goes there again. It has learned it better than the controls. And the same thing then was done, and you know about this, the same type of thing was done even in a mouse, where another gene was put in. In this case, it wasn't the same gene, it was another learning gene called, I'll just tell you what it's called, it was one of the NMDA receptors, and it was put into a mouse. And Joe Chen, who did this work when he was at Princeton, created what was called at the time the smart mouse. Who heard of the smart mouse? People, did you hear about that? That made the cover of Time magazine. He named it Doogie, and it could do the same thing. You put this gene. You know, it's possible to put genes into animals now. You can put them into humans even. And this gene was turned on all the time, and now the mouse could learn very, very quickly whether to go to the right or the left. In this case, it was actually to find a hidden platform in a maze. That there was basically you throw the animal into. Did you learn about Morris water mazes in this course yet? That you just throw the animal into a tank with water, and it has to swim to a platform that it sees out there, and then you submerge the platform below the water. It's milky water, so you can't see the platform. And now it has to remember where the platform was to find it, so it has to swim to it. And if it just wanders around aimlessly, it hasn't learned. But if it goes right to the spot, then it's learned, and everything in between.
When you say you're putting a gene into a mouse,
yes. So putting a gene into a mouse or into a fly, what that means is, again, it's... the way this is done is I mentioned before how you can take these genes, the nucleic acids, and synthesize them and spot them down on that chip. Well, there's another way of taking a gene. You can have the same type of situation where you make some sort of you have the gene in the same way, the same one that was in your test tube that you're going to put on the chip, but instead you put it into a little. It's more primitive even than a virus. It's called a plasmid, and you put this into this little control element, and then you inject it into an egg cell, and now this plasmid, which is, you can think of it like a virus, the virus finds its way into the nucleus and then finds its way to the DNA and inserts itself right into the DNA of the mouse. And that's how you make what's called a transgenic mouse. You've heard of that term, I'm sure. And you basically have to inject a gene that's in a plasmid into the egg cell, and then you put it into the germline, so that now not only will the mouse have it, but all the offspring of that mouse will also have it. That is technology that can even be done in humans right now. There are genes that we can put these smart genes into humans if we wanted to. But we're going to ask the next question if we want to. Yeah.
I'm wondering if there is some kind of possible emotional state from learning the experiments that you're describing to indicate, or some kind of a pressure state in terms of. So the last class we were talking a little bit about how emotion related to cognition and sort of a pressure-filled environment versus a pressure-filled environment versus a more relaxed environment, and it seems like a fruit fly getting shocked or a mammal trying to swim and not being able to. Yeah. They seem like high pressure situations, which in a classroom might be comparable to getting, your knuckles slapped or something like this.
Yeah.
Which, we don't do anymore, but still, like, we're probably moving in that direction towards a more relaxed atmosphere. But, is there any indication that a more relaxed atmosphere does help learning, or are there any experiments that have that as an assumption?
Yeah, well, what an interesting question to try. Clearly, when you're in a tense situation and the stakes are high, you have to learn. And if you don't learn, the consequences can be dire. But what we would like to know is whether or not how we can create these environments in more relaxed settings for learning. I think the way in biology if that's your hypothesis, that is that, you know, you're asking a question that is learning can take place in relaxed environments, and you set that up as your hypothesis, and now you want to test it. The first question the biologist would ask is that a testable hypothesis? And so to try to do that, you have to say, well, what is a relaxed environment for a mouse or a fruit fly? And that's where the trouble begins. We don't know how to actually necessarily create that. So I think that while it's a great question, it's still a little difficult to test it, I think, in some of the paradigms that I'm talking about.
In monkeys, a little smarter maybe than mice, but mice are pretty smart too, you can put them in an environment in which they're learning situations that they have the capacity to choose to go to or not.
Mm-hmm.
So, I know a laboratory in Edinburgh that all of its learning is done with this kind of situation. So, they can today they can choose to go into the learning room and learn some things and get some kind of little reward for it. But they don't have to do that. They're not starved. They're not going to drown.
Right.
It's just entirely their choice.
Uh-huh.
I would think you could set up similar things for mice, which like to explore.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when I did my research with rats, one of the first discoveries was that you couldn't even do the study unless you let them explore the environment first, because that was much more important for them than finding the food pellets.
Right.
So that would be a situation where you could have a more relaxed learning environment for a mouse.
Would, yes.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Yeah.
I was wondering if you've done any tests on the effectiveness of reward versus punishment, because sort of following up on what you were saying about the pressure of shock, there can also be pressure of reward, I think.
Yeah. So I think the answer is no, I have not. People, of course, do that kind of work. I think both of these questions are sort of getting to realms in which the psychologists have been operating in very, very clever ways. I don't think people like myself, the molecular biologists, have caught up yet to that level of refinement. What we're still doing is much more primitive work, and we have very standardized conditions like the T-tube and Omaris water maze, and they're used over and over and over again for these different genetically altered animals, so we can keep things very, very simple and standard. These are great questions, but I think they're still a little bit beyond the molecular level.
In terms of the introduction of these novel genetic toolboxes, and in this case, just having it, the crab being always on, in the genetic dysgenic mice, could have you identified like different changes, like visual changes in the relationship of these toolboxes and the system per se? There's actually, obviously, the transgenic mice are going to be totally different from the normal ones, but then I'm worried about the introduction of these new toolboxes that are constantly on, and how can they actually affect the overall work of other systems?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. That's the kind of question that, indeed, we would then move to, because those are questions that we can begin to address. That is, what other systems are affected, and when you make a transgenic animal, now let's see what else is being shut off, turned on, and look at the whole constellation of how the animal is more or less successful. So I would say that it's interesting, just before doing any experiments, just as a kind of a thought experiment, if you have a smart mouse as your pet, then the question is that how smart is it really? Is it that smart to make your decisions based on one experience? Or is the mouse really just jumping to conclusions? And so what we really have to think about is that maybe learning thresholds are preset, that you need a certain amount of, you need to make a certain number of mistakes biologically to be able to actually learn in a long-term way what the right answer is. Because if you because you're more likely to have if you want to store something in long-term memory, it better be right. And if it's only based on one experience, you could be in big trouble. And it seems that if it were advantageous to have, for us to have a photographic memory and to learn that easily, it would have already happened in an evolutionary way. Because as you saw from that gene chip a couple slides back, you know, all these experimenters did, especially the mouse guy, is just do something that would activate the promoters of these genes. They just turned them on a little bit more. Now, what are promoters? Promoters are just sequences in the genome. And their activity is based on that sequence. So if the transcription factor binds a little bit better, it makes more. If it binds a little bit less, it makes less. And if you change a few nucleotides, it might bind a little better. It's easy to change levels of gene expression. It's probably very important to set the levels of expression of learning toolbox genes at a point where we make the right number of mistakes to learn something in a way that makes it a valid fact. And what that threshold is and how it's set, and how it's set in different species or for different people, is very interesting to explore. Okay, so
I do just like to mark that. This is a really important point, I think. Is it clear to people?
This is, the previous picture was of a fruit fly. Now I've taken you, we talked about a mouse. I just want to show you, so just for the sake of completeness, that here is the memory entry organ in the human, that sort of turquoise structure there called the hippocampus, a small structure on each side of the brain. The area that's attacked very severely in Alzheimer's disease is where memories have to enter as a gateway before they get stored in the rest of the cortex. So, and it's indeed in this area in the mouse brain where some of those genes involved in the learning toolbox were targeted, because promoters do a lot. They don't just say, okay, I'm in a tough situation, I got to take this all this stress and use it as an activator for Kreb or whatever. Promoters do another thing too. They say that Kreb is supposed to be expressed in the brain, not in the kidney. They decide which organ it's going to be turned on in. And not only is it going to be expressed in the brain, but in specific places in the brain. And the hippocampus for learning and memory is a very key structure. Now, I'll just say parenthetically here that because we know a fair amount now about the learning toolbox, what I'm calling the learning toolbox, and know transcription factors and other genes, it means that it's really on the near horizon that there will be drugs that can alter the learning toolbox. Performance enhancers for students as well as our patients. And when we think about them for our patients, this is what we think about. As I get older, I find I rely more and more on these sticky notes to remind me. Of course, we can think of many clinical uses for small molecules, drugs, that will activate these pathways. These are really, we're talking not that far away. There are companies out there with big investments in actually making these drugs. And there's no reason why they're going to be, their use will be just limited to Alzheimer patients or older folks. So I think people in the field of education are eventually going to have to start thinking about, are we going to need to do urine tests before the final exam? So this takes us through one type of toolbox. I want to talk about another toolbox now that gets at more like a language toolbox. Let's talk about that for a few moments. If we think about language. And I think you've already had some talks on language here.
And some more coming.
So I'm only going to talk about it from a strictly molecular point of view, which maybe will not be covered. But what I do want to just say is that as a molecular biologist, my job is to be a reductionist, to take it down to what are the genes and the bare bones elements of what has to be assembled to make these complex structures. And you don't need information from me to reinforce how complex language is. But I will show you one slide that gets a little bit of that as to what happens in the brain when you watch a single word. Has anybody seen this before?
Yes.
You have, yeah. So this is basically, from the imaging group over at the Mass General in Charlestown. And what you see here is a brain imaged by MRI. And that orange thing that you just saw going through there is superimposed on the MRI is what's called an MEG, magneto-electroencephalography. What it is measuring the electrical activity in the brain. So the person whose brain this is was put into the machine to first image the brain and then superimpose upon it electrical activity. And the electrical activity was occurring while the person was looking at a single word, let's say castle. So the word castle was flashed up on the screen and the imaging began. And there it goes, and you see the time. So that what happened there, it's over in 800 milliseconds, less than a second. It's all over. The word was first seen back here in the visual cortex, where the electricity started, and then it spread forward. This is the left side of the brain, to the language area, and activated the language area, which presumably conveyed meaning to the word castle. And all of that happened in less than half a second. So it's hard as a molecular biologist to try to figure out how to jump into a problem of this level of complexity.
If anybody wants it elaborated, it's actually on our website as part of the Poldrack lecture on language development and brain imaging of language development.
Oh, is that right? Good. to think about the same problem from a molecular point of view, the way molecular biologists often get a toehold into a problem is not so much in this way, but when nature makes a mistake, when there are genetic errors, and that's our entree. So it turns out that there's a family that was discovered in England that have a genetic disease that is, it's inherited as an autosomal dominant trait. 50% of the offspring get it, generation after generation, in which they have a problem with articulation in this family, which is not uncommon. But in this particular family, there's also a language problem. That is, there's difficulty in really setting up and speaking in grammatically correct ways. As it goes beyond just articulation to affect language ability in this family. And the fact that this is inherited means that it's then possible to do the kinds of genetic sleuthing that I described in that fly, to actually then find the gene, to search for, to compare the 3 billion nucleotides in family members that have the conditions with those that don't. And it's a very big job to do that, and it involves a lot of statistics, but it is possible to get some answers. This is how genes of various diseases have been discovered. In this family, a gene indeed was discovered. It's a gene that is called FOXP2, and it has a mutation that causes this problem in the families. And does anybody know what this gene would most likely encode? Who wants to take a guess? Anybody know what this gene would be? Anybody?
Having a large bushy tail.
Yes, right. What category of gene would this be in? We've talked a little bit about this. Yes.
Transcription factor.
You got it. This is also a transcription factor.
There's a relationship between motor ability and grammar, articulation related to motor ability as well.
Right, and that's where we're going to go with this. That's exactly. That's the toehold. Exactly. So the here's the gene that seems to be able, when it's mutated, seems to be able to have this language problem, and it also turned out to be a transcription factor. So it's could it be? I'm using the word very reluctantly, but it has been used in the popular literature. I don't think we can quite justify this term yet, but could it be a language gene? And we don't really have the answer to this yet, but how can we go about beginning to answer that question? Well, again, evolution helps us a lot. That's the way we pursue problems. And it turns out that FOXP2 is present in a lot of different species. It's been around in phylogeny for millions of years. You can see it in mice. You can see it throughout mammalian radiation, and it's really extremely conserved. That is, that it's the nucleotides and the amino acids in mice and humans are really almost identical. So why would that be a language gene? These mice are not speaking, obviously. So the next step was to look a little bit more closely at the sequence now among primates. Maybe there are, between mice and humans, it's very well conserved. There might be only 3 or 4, 5 at the most differences. But when you go into primates, it turns out that the differences are now narrowed even further, and that even though the sequence is almost the same now in humans and all primates, there are two places that are different. And if you then compare orangutans to humans, there's only one place that's different. So we now have another clue. It doesn't prove anything. It just is another clue that something might have happened that mutated this gene during evolution, from very late in evolution, at the time when maybe humans separated from a common ancestor that gave rise on one limb to the great apes and another limb to humans. Yeah.
I just wonder how genes can be affected by environment. I'm curious how that effect was passed on during reproduction.
Yeah. So okay. So that's a little bit of a diversion from this story, but I'll answer you briefly, and then we can come back to that because it's a very important question. Only the sequence is passed on. So all the other stuff I talked about, the regulation of their levels, is in general not passed on. In general. So that every person starts all over from scratch, and you then, based on your experiences, set the levels of the genes that you've inherited. Now, I'm saying that with a few reservations, because it's a little bit more complicated than that. There are certain things that have been referred to as epigenetic phenomena, which again will take us into a much bigger diversion. It's another 2-hour lecture, but
we've had a lot of conversation early in the last semester about what epigenesis is, so they should have some idea what you're talking about.
Okay, so if you just want to put into this box of epigenesis these areas that can be inherited but that fall outside of the actual sequences that you're getting from your parents. And we'll leave it at that. We can come back to that. It's a really interesting area. So for this particular gene here, we're talking about FOXP2, it turns out that another small clue is that something changed from humans to great apes in a gene that looks like that can be mutated when patients have language trouble. And it's possible to do things that are called molecular clocks. You can trace through evolution the time when gene changes in the sequence arise. So we know that, for instance, the common ancestor, perhaps, for great apes and humans walked the earth about 7 million years ago. And there were all these hominid-like creatures around. And they gave rise to a lot of different species, Neanderthals and Australopithecus. You've heard of these names of other hominids that have since become extinct, and only Homo sapiens has managed to survive for reasons we don't understand. It's still a big mystery as to why Neanderthals became extinct.
People think that they merged in different populations. They're killed off in some other kind of.
Yeah. Again, it's another lecture, and I know that's one idea about is killed off. Recently, I saw an article that they were dependent on a different type of food source that was more sedentary animals, and that Homo sapiens was able to use food sources from migrating animals, and that accounted for the loss of Neanderthals. But it's clear they lived together for a period of time. There are caves in France where Neanderthals and Homo sapiens had lived in the same caves. And something resulted in their extinction. And I would say that this process of the extinction of our near neighbors, of our cousins, is still going on, as we see dwindling in the great ape population as well. The point of what I'm saying is though that you can look at you can put together DNA sequences from various great apes and humans and look at changes over in these species and then find out. Calculate their common ancestors and set up molecular clocks. And the reason I'm telling you all this is because basically the difference, that single difference between the orangutan and the humans probably occurred about 100,000 or 200,000 years ago. It's relatively recent. It's at the same time when the anthropologists are telling us that Homo sapiens woke up. That Homo sapiens probably was around for several hundreds of thousands of years, and then at around 100 to 50,000 years ago, suddenly we see this explosion of stuff. There's drawings and caves, there's diversity of tool use, people are burying their dead, there's jewelry. There's something that happened, even though the brain looks pretty much the same, at around 50 or 100,000 years ago, it seems as if there's this burst of cultural artifacts. And that, interestingly, seems to be about the time that we actually, using molecular clocks, date the change in FOXP2 to the human sequence from the sequence seen in orangutans and other great apes. Another minor clue. It's just, these are all just correlations. They don't prove anything. They just all point to the fact that we might be have an interesting lead here, and we should look some more at this gene. So, yes.
Did you say that they're random mutations, or that they're prescribed?
Yeah. So that's a deep. That's a very, very deep question. That gets to one of the really very profound areas in evolution. And I guess the first approximation to an answer to this would be that the mutations are random, and most of them are neutral, and a fair number are bad, but rarely there's one that's good. Now, we have to just... And I only say first approximation because we have to get rid of terms like good and bad, because it doesn't mean they're not, the good ones are not necessarily good in the sense of virtuous. Those good ones are good because they allowed the animal to survive in an aquatic environment. But then when it got hotter and now the water was gone and they had to survive in a desert, the good mutation can become the bad mutation. So everything is working here together, but the generator, the engine of evolution, in the simplest sense, is the fact that mistakes are made from generation to generation in the genome. And very rarely, but they're out of, you know, the copying rate of those 3 billion nucleotides is almost perfect. Not just perfect from generation to generation, but it has to be copied over and over and over again in the trillions of cells in your body. It's almost perfect, but there are a few mistakes. And when those mistakes get into the germline, then it actually can make a difference. Do you have a question?
Yeah. I'm just wondering if there's been any research where a human FOXP2 gene has been put into like an orangutan or other animal.
And it started to recite Shakespeare. Yeah. So the technology, it's people have not actually made too many transgenic orangutans yet. But people are interested in putting FOXP2 into a mouse. And I don't know the result of that. Yeah, I don't think it hasn't really been done yet. It may not be that interesting because for the reasons that we'll now talk about. I mean, this is how might this be a toolbox gene? And this gets to what the gentleman in the back was saying, that what this was thought, because this articulation problem goes together with the language problem, the way it's being thought about by this group of scientists is that this is a toolbox for creating perhaps the articulatory part of language. That is to make a larynx and a pharynx that is uniquely human. And indeed, these structures are different between Neanderthals and humans and other and great apes, so that we can actually generate language. I wrote down a couple of numbers here. I have to just look at this to remember how remarkable it is. Maybe you know some of this stuff. The average English speaker produces sentences at the rate of 140 to 180 words per minute. Are up to 126 milliseconds per syllable. So these muscles are really, these are moving unbelievably fast, creating subtle articulatory differences in long polysyllabic words that are just allowing us to say complex thoughts with subtle intonations and articulations. This is not so easy. And just like I had mentioned earlier, that say we think that in dogs the same trait that may create the shape of a borzoi also might create its trait for being interested in hunting. Well, maybe the same genes that are involved in a toolbox to make an oral pharynx, also those same genes might be captured by the brain to set up some of that language circuitry you saw on the first on the previous slide. Genes have many roles, so we could think that while the toolbox is there for an articulatory system in many species, maybe the FOXP2 is highly conserved, so maybe it's making, maybe we should think of it as a language gene, maybe we should think of it as a toolbox for a vocal apparatus of some sort that could either grunt or whistle or meow or bark or recite poetry. But it only can do the latter when those same genes are co-opted by the brain to do something in the brain that's as different as a wing of a butterfly compared to a leg on a cat. And that might be how the language toolbox could generate this kind of diversity. So we have two toolboxes there that that may be relevant for educators. I wonder if there's any questions at this point. This is probably yes.
Hi.
Hi.
In your article on phrenology, moving beyond phrenology, you talk about taking a comparative and or developmental approach to research to get out of the circular loop of, you come up with a function, and then you find a gene or a neuron, set of neurons behind the function, and, it feeds into itself. And how do you get out of that? And so I was just wondering if you could elaborate on that a bit and just kind of talk about, like, it just seems like our methodology can be limited, and that the function of a gene or a part of the brain is always more than the task that you're measuring. So how do you get from the, I know that it's a difficult task to move beyond this, but it's hard to picture if we're not using the techniques of localizing and stuff like that, then what are we doing? It's a hard question, but...
It is a hard question, and I think the article raises more questions than it is, and it doesn't answer actually very many questions.
Yeah.
And the idea is that it's more a matter of how we perhaps interpret our data than anything else. I think we really have to... It's not to denigrate any of those tools, which are essential tools. We need to make transgenic animals. We need to localize. We need to knock out genes. But to do all that, it's so easy to go beyond the data. And that's really, I think, the point. Go ahead. Yes.
I have a follow-up question on the FOXP2.
Yes.
How the genetic toolbox for language might affect two different systems, a voice system, an articulation system, and perhaps separately a grammar system in the brain. And I'm wondering if they're if you could talk a little bit more about if there's been much work done that would suggest that through articulation, a system for grammar might develop on the one hand, so a grammar system might develop through continued articulation going through that path, or if there are more separate paths that are both joined in the same toolbox. Do you understand my question?
I'm not sure if I do.
So first, I'll try and give an example. It's an imperfect example. Persons with hearing impairment actually, there may be several different causes of hearing impairment. Some of them are genetically linked. Others have no known cause or origin. Many times different children with different types of hearing impairment have different abilities to articulate, and in written language of these children who are prelingually deaf, their grammar is markedly poor, right? Even separate from the different types of sign language that they might use. So one person might argue that because they don't have this experience of articulation, that somehow that affects the way that their grammar develops in their brain. I was just wondering if you could speak to that point.
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's very hard to speak to that in terms of experiments. I suppose that I can actually, I don't know if there's time, if I can give you maybe one more story that would speak to this from a somewhat different perspective, because it's hard to figure out how to, again, to get back to the questions over here, how to design the experiment that you're proposing. You know, it's you would really have to then somehow discover the downstream genes. If FOXP2 is controlling a toolbox for not just articulation but also for language, how those, and then we would say that some of those genes that are regulating language are being expressed in the brain by a FOXP2 promoter. We have to begin to identify them. That would be the first step. And then to see that perhaps they were not turned on in cases of deafness. So, I mean, that would be a kind of approach to that problem. But it really, we don't even know what these downstream genes are yet for FOXP2.
If I can make a connection, Jessie Snedeker is coming to talk to us soon, and she, among other things in studying language development, is looking at deaf kids who have been given cochlear implants so that they start having hearing experiences, and among other things, what effect does that have on the spoken language that they produce? I could imagine that being a situation where you could begin to examine things like gene expression and how it changes after the cochlear implants are put in, and as a function of what kind of articulation the kids do.
I was going to say the same thing. Snedeker is coming next week, and there's a lot of research that's been done at the cognitive level of analysis as to what the relationship might be between the ability to receive phonetic differences and vocalization and interconnection between that and language acquisition. So that's a good question for her next week.
Thank you for getting. I can duck it then, right?
Yeah, you can duck it.
Yeah. I think, let's see, you want
to? I was going to say, last year there was an election out in who won. I don't know, I can't remember, but basically, you know, with the argument that the topic of the land is evolutionary, but it's like called all responsibility for why we're in the problem. And there's a lot of theory that suggests that other modalities and that our ability to vocalize is not virtually special language, and that there's evidence, a lot of domains of evidence that suggests that it's maybe one part of a certain part of language. And evolutionarily, we had this encouragement to not develop language, and I think that language, like many other cognitive high level domains that we deal with in education, are so many things going wrong. Even though this is one thing I kind of avoid, the domain specificity, all of it really fits in a lot of us skills and caps and stuff. And I'm looking at the evidence that so many genetic toolkits are incorporating different functions. I would imagine that without you, I mean, that's going to go to show that there's multiple factors when we're playing.
So, I think actually I should maybe back off from giving one whole more story. Maybe next time we can do some more stuff. We're coming up on the hour. We do have maybe 2 minutes for another question or two. Anybody else? Yes.
A lot of the questions we raise, they might be, as Brewer says, a bridge too far as of yet. But you said that a lot of the stuff that we like to color our conceptualization is more metaphoric than it is scientific. But I see a lot of stuff that you say here in one of your articles. It says, individual neurons tuned to feature responders allow the brain to extract enough data from the physical world for the organism to compete successfully. And that kind of does sound like the stuff that we like, you know, psychologists and other people would say is like, you know, modules or, you know, different. Would you go as far as like to see a more of a sharing of information and language, even though it's jargon at this point, because it seems to be tying together such good definitions of the way we conceptualize the mind?
Sharing information between?
Interdisciplinary. You know, kind of like an integration between the way that development psychologists, evolutionary psychologists, and people like yourself maybe start collaborating and sharing information and seeing that maybe some of these genetic influences that create such things as what, you know, an evolutionary psychologist might call a module.
Right. I would be... that's something that I'm actually feel very strongly about, and Kurt knows that it's... it's my strong opinion that we very much need to have more conversations between molecular biologists and evolutionary psychologists and educators and the whole spectrum of people, because it may start out with metaphors, but then suddenly you see that there's an experiment there, or there's something that just takes off, and there's a lot of discoveries to be made. It's a real important facet, I think, of having knowledge grow that, in my own opinion, is slightly neglected in many universities, including this one.
And while there's lots of problems with the Bridge Too Far, as you were saying, as in so many areas in my brain and education, we can't just sit in our thumbs and wait for better knowledge, because, you know, there are drug companies right now working to use these technologies to enhance memory and learning, and they don't have any idea what effects they're going to have on people taking tests in HT100, right?
Yeah.
you know, there are all kinds of things like that that are happening, we thank you for being interested in having these conversations. I think that they're really essential for making the uses of biology in education beneficial, as opposed to a kind of haphazard and sometimes disastrous.
Thank you very much.